We hope this explanation of God's word enriches your life. To help you understand the audience for this talk, we suggest you read the context material on the About Us page. Please read also our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material from philipjensen.com. The following sermon was given at St. Matthias Family Church, where Philip Jensen was senior minister.
Well, tonight we go for three chapters in looking at Daniel chapter 10, 11 and 12. Long and complex chapters. So it's a challenge to keep ourselves on board. The kind of sermon where your mind will drift in and out and in and out, but keep working at being on the in rather than on the out. Of course, you can rest assured that you'll miss the point when you're asleep there, and you'll wonder what we're talking about when you suddenly realise that you've drifted again. This is a hard work sermon. It's a hard work passage. I've got James and David are going to read to us down here, they're sitting, in case you wonder where the voices come and whether God is now taking over the building. They're actually going to be down there, and they will read at certain stages during the proceedings. But we need to find Daniel chapter 10, 11 and 12. Now remember the situation. Daniel's in Babylon, in captivity. The 70 years have pretty well run their full circuit now, and where Daniel's been praying, facing Jerusalem, and reminding God of the promises of Jeremiah that after 70 years the captives will be released and sent home. Not only is he reminding them God of that and appealing to God to come and vindicate his holy name, as Ezekiel prophesied that God would do also, but Daniel has now had a vision, and an appearance of Gabriel, the great angel, has come to him and said, the restoration is about to take place, but it is a far bigger, greater restoration than you're thinking about. And the 70 years are far greater 70 years than you're thinking about. So we get this pattern that you see often in prophetic or especially apocalyptic literature in the scriptures. Apocalyptic literature, things like Ezekiel, parts of Daniel, Mark chapter 13, Luke 21, Matthew 24, 25, and the whole book of Revelation, which is called the Apocalypse. All that kind of strange literature full of symbolism. But they have this pattern of saying this event here is really an example of this big event over here, and jumping from one to the other so that you actually get a little confused sometimes as to which is being talked about. So Jesus looks at the temple and the disciples say, what marvellous stones, isn't it an enormous temple, what a fantastic building, it leaves the opera house down here for dead, because it took longer to build the temple in Jerusalem than it did to build the eastern suburbs railway, and we all know how long that was. So there's this huge construction site that's still going up. It's only about two-thirds up by the time Jesus is around. Still going up, these huge stones. They're all marvelling there at the wonder of it. And Jesus says, see, this temple is going to be destroyed. Not a stone left on a stone. And so he talks about this. They say, when will this happen? What will be the signs? And he starts telling them about it. And as you start telling them about it, you realise that he's not talking about the end of the temple. He's talking about the end of the world. And just when you've made the leap yourself and you say, oh, we're not really talking about the temple, we're talking about the end of the world. He says, pray that it doesn't happen in winter. You see, the end of the world, I mean, summer, winter, what the heck, you know? And pray for those who are pregnant at the time. Why? What special problem is there of being pregnant when the world ends? And that seems, and pray for those that you flee from the city. And you think, well, he's not talking about the end of the world. He's still talking about Jerusalem and the temple here. Because he talked about when you see the armies surrounding the city. You know, well, I was wrong. He wasn't talking about the end of the world. And just when you get back to the temple, suddenly he bursts forth in these great statements about the sun will lose its colour and the stars fall from the sky. Boy, he is confused or I am confused. Now, it's a form of literature. And that's the kind of thing Gabriel has picked up. He says, you're interested in the 70 years? Let me tell you about the 70 times 7 years. Yes, you're right. The 70 years are up. Yes, the people are going to come home. Yes, that's going to... But not quite the time and way you expect. Bigger, grander, greater is the scheme down the track. Now, it's in this kind of context that Daniel sees a vision, chapter 10. A great vision occurs to Daniel, which many of the themes have gone all the way to this book. And it's a vision which continues right through chapter 11 and right through chapter 12, and that's why we run the three chapters together. I can't possibly answer all the questions that you may have about individual verses here. we will skate across the surface of them. There are all kinds of details, especially in chapter 11, which I just won't address it to. We'll read them and I'll point out the general line of direction about them. Can I commend you, if you want to follow through, or indeed if you collect in commentary, that the Tyndale commentary by Joyce Baldwin in the Green Tyndale series is an excellent commentary on the book of Daniel. I commend it warmly. It's a very fine Malachi, Zechariah, etc., and that was also a very helpful commentary. And I hope that we'll see more things coming from her pen. The one on Daniel is very good, and you can trace out the details in a book like that. But having read through the details, I can't remember them. And so the only way I'm going to be able to answer your questions is by standing here with a book and summing it up and telling you the details. And you may as well get the book yourself and sum it up. And if you can remember the details, well, bully for you. It's just kind of minutia that will be a bit irritating. So what we've got to do is skate over the minutia and see the general principle of what the vision is about. So we'll have a bit of a question time at the end, but don't get yourself all hyped up, because you'll be able to ask me every little bit and nook and cranny and jot and tittle of these passages, and I'll be able to answer them, because I won't be able to, and we're not going to spend time on that. Also, I'm sorry to say I'll be leaving straight after the sermon tonight. My wife is slightly indisposed. Don't worry about it. Please don't send thousands of cards and presents and all the rest of it. Just money orders. It's all right. It's just that, though, with 3 hours of the kids alone, that this hour of the Sunday night, the house will be in chaos if I don't get back here fairly quickly afterwards, all right? She'll be right tomorrow morning with no sweat, just provide I can get the kids from her throat. Or them from her from them, as the case may be. So the question time, we're not going to get very far along the track of detail, but the general principles, I'm happy we'll have a general question time if we can get through the reading and through the whole section quickly enough. So let's go first of all. In chapter 10, Daniel, in the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia, has a revelation given to him. Now, here is the event, and it's all about a man who is in charge. And I would remind you that back in Daniel chapter 7, when Daniel saw the end of the world, he saw the Ancient of Days and the judgment time, that the kingdoms of the world were given to one who was a man, a son of man. That in the end, the ruler of the universe is a man. And I think, although it's not explicit in this passage, I think that is the man to whom we hear now come to Daniel. There's also reference in this part to a person called Michael. Michael is a prince, an angelic prince, an archangel like Gabriel or something like that. And he is the patron angel, if you like, the defending angel, the prince of the people of Israel, who is at war and helps at war in heavenly battles. And so there are two particular elements of this chapter I draw your attention to, you see in the outline. One is to see the man who is in charge and see what it says about him. And the other is to see that we're dealing with the world and the super world. That there is not just the events of human history, but behind them, in the wings outside where our normal vision ranges, there are all kinds of powers and principalities at work that are referred to here. So, David and James, how about you do chapter 10 for us? Hold it. I don't think they can hear at the back. Can you hear at the back? They can't hear halfway down. What's happening to that microphone? Change it. That's what's happening to it. Here's another one here. That one is working. How's yours, James? Is it working? I don't think James is using it. Speaking to it, James. Hello? Yeah. Hello, he's here. Righto, away we go. Chapter 10, Daniel.
In the year of Cyrus, king of Persia, a revelation was given to Daniel, who was called Belteshazzar. Its message was true, and it concerned a great war. The understanding of the message came to him in a vision. At that time, I, Daniel, mourned for 3 weeks. I ate no choice food, no meat or wine touched my lips, and I used no lotions at all until the 3 weeks were over. On the 24th day of the first month, as I was standing on the bank of the great river, the Tigris, I looked up, and there before me was a man dressed in linen, the belt of the finest gold around his waist. His body was like chrysolite, and his face like lightning, his eyes like flaming torches, his arms and legs like the gleam of burnished bronze, and his voice like the sound of a multitude. I, Daniel, was the only one who saw the vision, and the men with me did not see it. But such terror overwhelmed them that they fled and hid themselves. So I was left alone, gazing at this great vision. I had no strength left. My face turned deathly pale, and I was helpless. Then I heard him speaking, and as I listened to him, I fell into a deep sleep, my face to the ground. A hand touched me and set me trembling on my hands and knees. He said,
Daniel, you who are highly esteemed, consider carefully the words I'm about to speak to you, and stand up, for I have now been sent to you.
And when he said this to me, I stood up trembling. Then he continued,
Do not be afraid, Daniel. Since the first day that you set your mind to gain understanding and to humble yourself before your God, your words were heard, and I have come in response to them. But the prince of the Persian kingdom resisted me 21 days. Then Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me, because I was detained there with the king of Persia. Now I have come to explain to you what will happen to your people in the future, for the vision concerns the time yet to come.
While he was saying this to me, I bowed with my face towards the ground and was speechless. Then one who looked like a man touched my lips, and I opened my mouth and began to speak. I said to the one standing before me, I am overcome with anguish because of the vision, my Lord, and I am helpless. How can I, your servant, talk with you, my Lord? My strength is gone and I can hardly breathe. Again the one who looked like a man touched me and gave me strength.
Do not be afraid, O man highly esteemed, he said. Peace, be strong now, be strong.
When he spoke to me, I was strengthened and said, Speak, my Lord, since you have given me strength. So he said,
You know why I have come to you? Soon I will return to fight against the prince of Persia, and when I go, the prince of Greece will come. But first I will tell you what is written in the book of truth. No one supports me against them except Michael your prince, and in the first year of Darius the Mede, I took my stand to support and protect him.
Thanks, Phyllis. Well, he's an extraordinary vision, isn't he, this man? And one of enormous power, such that Daniel just falls down as if dead before him. It's an image that you see similarly in the book of Ezekiel. Ezekiel met a man like it in Babylon, in the first chapter or so of Ezekiel. And John the Apostle meets such a man in the book of Revelation. He speaks and is dressed like the victorious man that he is, like God, speaking with the sounds of multitudes. He doesn't reject Daniel falling down at his feet like an angel and a creature should, but rather raises him up and imparts power to him, touches him so that he can speak and so forth. He is the one who is in charge, who is in control. But yet, while he is in charge and in control, there is still opposition to him. So in verse 13, the prince of Persia resisted him for 21 days. And you will see that there is some controversy there in chapter 10, the last verse, and the first verse of chapter 11. That at one stage he supports Darius the Mede, but later, of course, he is going to oppose him. It raises for us the whole question of the world and the superworld. Now, I confess to you that I do not like people knowing that I believe in angels. I don't know that. You might like people knowing that you believe in angels, but whenever I say to people I believe in angels, I expect them to say, oh yes, and fairies down the bottom of your garden too. Because I have a very materialistic, rationalistic framework of mindset, well-tuned for the Western 20th century way of thinking, which sees the whole universe in closed order kind of pattern, so that there is just cause and effects that run around, that there's just a world of existence, that there's nothing outside what we know of can test, examine, look at, feel, taste and the rest. And although you can kind of superimpose God on that, and on the quiet you might actually believe in the devil as well, the idea that there's other beings roaming around, that really is not particularly acceptable. That seems a bit strange and, well, fairies and hobgoblins and all that kind of thing. And so there is a tendency to want to kind of pull back from ever acknowledging that you believe in angels, cherubims and seraphims and things that go bump in the night. Francis Schaeffer said that whenever he preached on university campuses, he would always mention that he believed in angels. I had a tape of him saying that once. I went back and listened again. Shock, horror, filled me. One could say I was flabbergasted and you wouldn't want to get typecast. So I couldn't work out how it was that you would want to go into, of all rationalist centres, the university, and declare that you believed in angels. His argument is, though, that it's very important to say you believe in angels, because then people realise that you're not talking about morality, that you're talking about supernaturalism, that you're talking about a perception of reality which is not just this world. A perception of reality which says there is more to this world than this world. There's more to the universe than the universe. There is the super world. There is the other world. There is the other existence. There is the outside that can invade into the inside. Now, for some of us, that's no great hassle, because we know of it through our own perceptions, our own senses. I was interested to hear a talkback show on the radio this week about American psychologist who's doing some experiments out here and wanted people to contact him, because he says they've found now that 14% of the community have had some form of experiences of the extrasensory, extraterrestrial, extra whatever it is. But that although 14% will acknowledge in private that they have had it, in public it's very hard to get anybody to say that they've had it. Because as soon as you say, well, a strange thing happened to me, you know, I was driving along the country road and suddenly I saw my grandmother, who is dead 30 years, standing beside the road. And so I screeched to a halt, and with that a meteor fell right in front of me on the road, and it would have killed me except for my grandmother had stopped me. And then I looked around and she disappeared. Now, if that happened to you, would you go home and tell anybody? Okay, yeah, that happens to me when I leave the Royal at late at night too. You know, I mean, it's that kind of material, isn't it? You don't say that kind of thing. However, this man says that 14% of the community have had those kinds of experiences. And you start to wonder, well, is there a large man? I understand Prince Charles is going to come clean on the television. Is it tonight or last night or tomorrow night? Are we all missing it? Well, he's going to come clean anyway, very soon. Very soon he's going to come clean and tell us about his experience of supernaturalism. And he is going down the track that sounds to me like occultism, which of course is the head of the Church of England. Where else would you expect him to go, I guess? Strange kind of pattern and behaviour to be in, but he's not there yet. We still have our gracious Sovereign Lady. But maybe we should return to pray for Prince Charles and all the royal family a little bit more fervently. A very sad thing, actually, if the head of the state starts to fiddle around in that area, and it certainly sounds that it's going in that direction. But why? Because he has experienced something of supernaturalism, and the only people who speak about it are the occult. For Christians have accepted the rationalistic, this world only perception of reality. And we are very embarrassed about angels and demons and devils and powers and princes of Persia and all this kind of thing. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that we want to keep quiet, because our rationalistic, atheistic friends will kind of giggle at us and laugh behind their... And so when people actually experience the supernatural, if that is what they are experiencing, it could be just psychology, it could be just something abnormal in their minds, it could be having too much drink, for all we know. But when they experience something that goes beyond that perception of the world, they shut up about it and look for the only people who talk about it who happen to be down the occult track. And so, here we come to it. It doesn't come out in the Bible all the time, but it does come out clearly and significantly at some time. And here we are looking into the super world. That's what happens. Only he sees it, the others around him don't. They're filled with dread, but he sees the man who is in charge, and he hears about the fact of warfare taking place in the heavens. most world religions are divided on several issues. They're all different. Don't ever go on that nonsense. They're all different ways of the same God and they're saying the same thing. They hardly agree upon anything. You're hard-pressed to find a thing they agree upon. Now, one of the things they clearly divide on is dualism and monism. Monism is the idea that reality is ultimately singular. If you want to have a little sleep, this is a good time, they say. That reality is ultimately singular, that everything in the end comes back to the one reality. That diversity is an illusion. That ultimately what you must do is find the great one. The end, the ultimate, the good, the whatever that one may be on itself. And you come back to it and you find it in Hinduism, you'll find it in Buddhism, you'll find it in the Greek philosophies like Plato and Socrates and Stoicism. That ultimate reality is all one and everything is just an expression of that one total reality. On the other hand, groups like Zoroastrians, the Persians, believed in dualism. That ultimately there are two. There is the good and there is the bad. And they are at warfare with each other. Now, monism has terrible problems in the area of morality. Because if everything's the same, then what's the difference what you do? It doesn't matter. Everything's whether you kill people or kiss people, it really doesn't matter. It's all expressions of the same one reality. And so ethics has big problems in monistic systems. Dualism has terrible insecurity because you never know if the bad guy's going to win. I mean, you know on television because you've got to have the hero for next week's television show. But in the ultimate, you don't know. And so this warfare that goes between the good and the bad, which you can see traced down through human history, which you can feel within yourself, which you can see in your neighbours, that warfare, you're not sure how it's going to turn out. Where does Christianity fall in all this? Christianity is a limited dualistic system. Not monistic, not everything is one, because there are other beings like the Prince of Persia, who will contend with the man who is in charge. But he is in charge. It's limited dualism because there's no doubt who's going to win. Ultimately, we've already been told in chapter 7 that all authority, all kingdoms, all nations, all powers are given into the hands of this man. That ultimately, there is a man in charge. And so we have here in this introduction to the vision a picture of the man who is in charge and something of the supernatural activity that is taking place behind the events of the world. All kinds of events are happening today. And these events are influenced by the forces that are in the super world. In what ways, I don't know. You can't from this say, okay, well now I know, you see, that because the Arabs stole a liner, the Egyptians hate the Americans and the Italian government's changed. All in a week. That's a fantastic scenario, isn't it? Who would have believed it? Well, that's because the Prince of the Egyptians, and I don't know what's happened behind the scenes. I only know it in terms of this world, and that's confusing enough, isn't it? That's confusing enough. But somewhere behind it all are the influences and powers of principalities, of beings. It's all caught up in the machinations of the universe in rebellion against God. But it is all under the control of this man. It's important for us to understand that it's under his control and power, and that it's not only in the affairs in the hands of mankind, for our prayers and for our confidence. And that's particularly important for the Jews at this point in their history. And so the man in verse 14 of chapter 10 says, I have come to explain to you what will happen to your people in the future. For the vision that he's just about to give him concerns a time yet to come. The people of Israel have been promised their 70-year release. They're going home. The kingdom's going to be established. But now he's saying, it's not like you expect. And so I'm coming to tell you what to expect. Because if you go home with this expectation, you'll be wrong. Because power's going to come, warfare's going to come, suffering's going to come, difficulty's going to come, and you'll say, well, where's God in all this? Well, I'm telling you where God is in all this. And so we get chapter 11. In chapter 11, we're given the details of the history of Israel beforehand. Details of what happens between the Babylonian captivity and the reign of Antiochus Epiphanes the Fourth. Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes, a Seleucid king in the 2nd century BC. Details which are accurate, though you and I, because we're ignorant of ancient history, we'll just run our eyes over them and say, oh yes, fancy that, fancy that. I wonder who on earth this is all about. But if you care to get books like Joyce Baldwin's or just trace it out through any commentary, you'll be able to find that the details that are recorded here actually happen. So accurately, so detailed are these events, that many modern skeptics believe that they were written afterwards. Because you couldn't predict beforehand this material so accurately. It's not vague, it's not generalised, it is precise. And if you don't therefore believe in God, you don't believe in the supernatural, you don't believe in the possibility of God predicting the future, you're only left with what? Somebody, it's a forgery, it's been written afterwards. The problem with such a belief, of course, is that if it was written in the second century afterwards, how did the author know so much of the details of Babylonian life that we've seen in the previous chapters? Because there are all kinds of trivia detail about Babylonia that was not really known in the second century. That other Jewish historians had Babylonian life completely vague and un-Babylonian. But Daniel has it right when he is giving detailed description of Babylonian life in the 6th century BC. So you have a problem there, really, don't you? How could he be so accurate about the past when no one else could be? The eyewitness account then gives you another problem. How can he foretell the future so accurately? For those who are believers in God, that's not a great hassle. For those who aren't a believer in God, well, I always like giving you a problem. How about we read through it in sections here? Why don't you go down to the end of verse 4, thanks, James.
Now then, I tell you the truth. Three more kings will appear in Persia, and then a fourth who will be far richer than all the others. When he has gained power by his wealth, he will stir up everyone against the kingdom of Greece. Then a mighty king will appear who will rule with great power and do as he pleases. After he has appeared, his empire will be broken up and parcelled out towards the four winds of heaven. It will not go to his descendants, nor will it have the power he exercised, because his empire will be uprooted and given to others.
Well, that is what happened, of course. The Persian Empire fell to Alexander the Great. But Alexander the Great, whose power extended beyond that of his followers, didn't pass his kingdom on to his descendants. He was cut off in his prime. The saying goes, by the time Alexander the Great was my age, he was already dead 8 years. Cut very quickly down. Astonishing was the program. Because he covered the world and then died. His kingdom was divided into four, and now there are two parts of that four that become important. One are the Seleucids and the other are the Ptolemies. You spell it any way you like. The Ptolemies, they're easier to explain. They're in Egypt. They're the south. The Ptolemies are in the south. The Seleucids are in the north, Turkey and the rest. The dividing line between the Seleucids, the northern empire, and the Ptolemies, the southern empire, was around Palestine. So that if these two great empires, a quarter of the known world, have a fight, they will have a fight in Israel. Not because they're interested in Israel, but that's just because where their border is. And so, because of what is about to happen to the Greek Empire, the people of Israel are not going to be at peace until the Greeks are overcome. And that's what you read about now, as firstly the southern kingdom tries to stretch its muscles up and spread up into the north, and then the northern kingdom stretches its muscles and presses down into the south. Let's do the southern ones first, James, verses 5 to 9.
The king of the south will become strong, but one of his commanders will become even stronger than he and will rule his own kingdom with great power. After some years they will become allies. The daughter of the king of the south will go to the king of the north to make an alliance, but she will not retain her power, and he and his power will not last. In those days she will be handed over, together with her royal escort and her father, and the one who supported her. One from her family line will arise to take her place. He will attack the forces of the king of the north and enter his fortress. He will fight against them and be victorious. He will also seize their gods, their metal images, and their valuable articles of silver and gold, and carry them off to Egypt. For some years he will leave the king of the north alone. Then the king of the north will invade the realm of the king of the south, but will retreat to his own country.
So the first stage is peace, marriage alliance, and then, because the marriage doesn't work out too well, the family attack, the plunder, and now from here on in there's going to be fights between these two kingdoms. Now, like I say, if you want to, you can actually find out who that woman was and who the man was and what the fights were about. It's easy enough to do it. You can actually do it out of secular historian books, like, you know, get the Cambridge History of the Ancient World, the Cambridge Ancient History thing, and look it up, and you can trace out all these people and individuals. But, dear Bible readers, you don't need to know those details to make sense of the passages about. Right? That's why you've got the general drift of the north and the south, and the relevance is that Israel is the very spot where all the fights are taking place. Go for a longer read this time, mate. Chapter verses 10 to 20 will give you the rising now of the northern kingdom in power over the south.
His sons will prepare for war and assemble a great army, which will sweep on like an irresistible flood and carry the battle as far as his fortress. Then the king of the south will march out in rage and fight against the king of the north, who will raise...
Go for a longer read this time, mate. Verses 10 to 20 will give you the rising now of the northern kingdom in power over the south.
His sons will prepare for war and assemble a great army, which will sweep on like an irresistible flood and carry the battle as far as his fortress. Then the king of the south will march out in rage and fight against the king of the north, who will raise a large army, but it will be defeated. When the army is carried off, the king of the south will be filled with pride and will slaughter many thousands. Yet he will not remain triumphant, for the king of the north will muster another army, larger than the first. And after several years, he will advance with a huge army, fully equipped. In those times, many will rise against the king of the south. The violent men among your own people will rebel in fulfillment of the vision, but without success. Then the king of the north will come and build up siege ramps and will capture a fortified city. The forces of the south will be powerless to resist. Even their best troops will not have the strength to stand. The invader will do as he pleases. No one will be able to stand against him. He will establish himself in the beautiful land and will have the power to destroy it. He will determine to come with the might of his He will determine to come with the might of his entire kingdom and will make an alliance with the king of the south. And he will give him a daughter in marriage in order to overthrow the kingdom. But his plans will not succeed or help him. Then he will turn his attention to the coastlands and will take many of them. But a commander will put an end to his insolence and will turn his insolence back upon him. After this, he will turn back towards the fortress of his own country, but will stumble and fall, to be seen no more. His successor will send out a tax collector to maintain the royal splendour. In a few years, however, he will be destroyed, yet not in anger or in battle.
Well, it's the normal pattern, isn't it, that you see anywhere in world of warfare, one jostling the other, trying to make alliances through marriage, sending out tax collectors, winning in battles, all the exercises of power and intrigue that follow the course of human history. The beautiful land of verse 16 is, of course, the promised land. It's been referred to already in the book of Daniel as the beautiful land. And there you see that the people of your own land in verse 14 try and enter into the fight. They back one side against the other, but they'll pick the wrong side and they'll keep on losing, because that's the way it is. That's not God's plan for them to be victorious at this stage. They will be overrun and now controlled by the Seleucids, the northern empire. Now, it is amongst the Seleucids that this particular evil man called Antiochus arrived. Antiochus IV was
a megalomaniac. He was a kind of Idi Amin, Joe Stalin, Adolf Hitler, and I won't mention any local boys, who really perceived himself as God. He took on his title Epiphanes, which is a word which means manifestation of the divine. Manifestation, that's what the word means. But it was a manifestation of the divine, and he actually set out coins which identify himself as God. It's a megalomania on a grand scale, isn't it? To actually perceive yourself as God. He is the man in control. Now, of course, you're supposed to see in it the stark contrast with the man who really is in control. This man tries to be in control by grasping, by power, by army, by murder, by stealth, by all the warfare, whereas the man who is really in control is given authority from above, from the Ancient of Days, and who is in fact a meek man, gentle in his ways, and we know much more of him because of the New Testament. He is described here in this section as a contemptible person. It was a great crisis point in the history of Israel around 170 BC. Because it occurs between the Old Testament and the New Testament, most Christians are ignorant of it. It's not recorded as occurring in the history. There's no eyewitness account in the Old Testament. And by the New Testament, it's 170 years old, so it's well known and no one actually pays all that much attention. So it's not described for us. But just because it's not part of the Bible's history doesn't mean it wasn't a moment of great crisis. In fact, it was a moment of enormous crisis, which lies behind much of the imagery of the Bible. The imagery that's going to be spelt out for you in the next few verses, but the imagery of the book of Revelation, or Jesus' references to the abomination that desolates and all that. Antiochus for 3 years captured the city of Jerusalem and the temple of Jerusalem. He offered his own sacrifices inside the temple, thus defiling it, and then he suspended all temple services for 3 years. He ruled the people with terrible tyranny. At that time, a group called the Maccabeans rose up and fought. They were guerrilla fighters in the hills, a handful of men against a mighty empire. It really stood no chance at all, except at one. It was a marvellous exercise, the fact that guerrillas are hard to really stop and to repress. And you would have thought that the Americans could have learnt the lesson, but not in their Bible either. So these Maccabeans won, and after an astonishingly short time, 3 years, a time, two times, and another time, half a time, about 3.5 years, the Antiochus lost control of the temple in Jerusalem and went off and himself died. And so the people, the services commenced again, and the people saw it as a great liberation from God. Now, that is what is being foretold in this next section. However, the details now become less precise, so that those who are cynics and can't believe in predictions say, aha, that's because it is being written at the very time of Antiochus Epiphanes, so they don't know how it's going to turn out. And what it is being written for is to encourage people that this was always the plan, so don't worry about it. And the whole book of Daniel is written from that perspective, you see. You're told, here's Antiochus Epiphanes destroying Jerusalem. They say, ah, don't worry about it. Remember Nebuchadnezzar came, didn't he? Just be godly like Daniel. Remember they threw him into, they didn't throw him in the lions. They threw him in the lions then. They threw the mates off into the fiery furnace and they got out all right. Stand firm against Epiphanes. We'll conquer as well. That is taken from the view that it couldn't have been foretold. If you believe that it's been foretold, and I do for several reasons, not the least the fact that the history and the description is so accurate of the 6th century Babylonian life, if you see this foretold, then the reason you're being foretold this is because the people of Israel have been sent home on the great promise that the kingdom of God is coming. And by the time you reach the 2nd century, it is hard-pressed to see what the kingdom of God means now. Because we've not even got the temple services anymore. We don't even own the city anymore. We are now oppressed by the pagan who's just as bad, if not as worse, than Nebuchadnezzar. The people need to be forewarned that that is going to be the character of the 70 times 7 years, the 490 years that we're waiting through, the long period of time waiting for the real kingdom of God to arrive. And so that is the reason for it being foretold. And the reason it gets vague is because we move into that section where you're talking about this issue, but you start to realise he's actually talking about the end. And somewhere in this section, and every second commentator disagrees where, somewhere in this section you stop talking about Antiochus Epiphanes and you start talking about the end of the world or the coming of Jesus. Somewhere along the line, it happens. Well, let's pick it up around verse 21, aren't we, up to James, and go through to the end of chapter 11.
He will be succeeded by a contemptible person who has not been given the honour of royalty. He will invade the kingdom when its people feel secure, and he will seize it through intrigue. Then an overwhelming army will be swept away before him. Both it and a prince of the covenant will be destroyed. After coming to an agreement with him, he will act deceitfully, and with only a few people he will rise to power. When the richest provinces feel secure, he will invade them and will achieve what neither his fathers nor his forefathers did. He will distribute plunder, loot, and wealth among his followers. He will plot the overthrow of fortresses, but only for a time. With a large army, he will stir up his strength and courage against the king of the south. The king of the south will wage war with a large and very powerful army, but he will not be able to stand because of the plots devised against him. Those who eat from the king's provisions will try to destroy him. His army will be swept away and many will fall in battle. The two kings, with their hearts bent on evil, will sit at the same table and lie to each other, but to no avail because an end will still come at the appointed time. The king of the north will return to his own country with great wealth, but his heart will be set against the Holy Covenant. He will take action against it and then return to his own country. At the appointed time, he will invade the south again, but this time the outcome will be different from what it was before. Ships of the western coastlands will oppose him, and he will lose heart. Then he will turn back and vent his fury against the Holy Covenant. He will return and show favour for those who forsake the Holy Covenant. His armed forces will rise up to desecrate the temple fortress and will abolish the daily sacrifice. Then they will set up the abomination that causes desolation. With flattery he will corrupt those who have violated the covenant, but the people who know their God will firmly resist him. Those who are wise will instruct many, though for a time they will fall by the sword, or be burned, or captured, or plundered. When they fall, they will be received. When they fall, they will receive a little help, and many who are not sincere will join them. Some of the wise will stumble, so that they may be refined, purified, and made spotless until the time of the end, for it will still come at the appointed time. The king will do as he pleases. He will exalt and magnify himself above every god, and will say unheard of things against the God of gods. He will be successful until the time of wrath is completed. For what has been determined must take place. He will show no regard for the God of his fathers, or for the one desired by women, nor will he regard any god, but will exalt himself above them all. Instead of them, he will honour a god of fortress, a god unknown to his fathers. He will honour with gold and silver, with precious stones and costly gifts. He will attack the manifest fortress with the help of a foreign god, and will greatly honour those who acknowledge him. He will make them rulers over many people and will distribute the land at a price. At the time of the end, the king of the south will engage him in battle, and the king of the north will storm out against him with chariots and cavalry and a great fleet of ships. He will invade many countries and sweep through them like a flood. He will also invade the beautiful land. Many countries will fall, but Edom, Moab, and the leaders of Ammon will be delivered from his hand. He will extend his power over many countries. Egypt will not escape. He will gain control of the treasures of gold and silver and all the riches of Egypt, with the Libyans and Nubians in submission. But reports from the east and the north will alarm him, and he will set out in a great rage to destroy and annihilate many. He will pitch his royal tent between the seas at the beautiful holy mountain. Yet he will come to his end, and no one will help him.
So here is this particular contemptible person, and the chapter is very much about him. Notice just in terms of the size, that the first 20 verses take you from the Persian Empire down to 170, and then 25 verses are given to this particular ruler. Of course, this was a matter of particular crisis. Well, chapter 12 gives to us the end of this vision. And in chapter 12, Daniel learns the outcome of it all. He learns the outcome at the end of times. Because with the life and death and power and destruction of Antiochus Epiphanes, you have an example of what the ultimate outcome is to be. How about we pick it up there, fellas, and start reading in chapter 12 through for us. No, ready?
At the time Michael began?
Which?
At the time Michael, the great prince who protects your people, will arrive. There will be a time of distress such as has not happened from the beginning of nations until then. But at that time your people, everyone whose name is found written in the book, will be delivered. Multitudes who sleep in the dust of the earth will awake, some to everlasting life, others to shame and everlasting contempt. Those who are wise will shine like the brightness of the heavens, and those who lead many to righteousness like the stars for ever and ever. But you, Daniel, close up and seal the words of the scroll until the time of the end. Many will go here and there to increase knowledge.
Then I, Daniel, looked, and there before me stood two others, one on this bank of the river and one on the opposite bank. One of them said to the man clothed in linen, who was above the waters of the river,
"How long will it be before these astonishing things are fulfilled?"
The man clothed in linen, who was above the water of the river, lifted his right hand and his left hand towards heaven. And I heard him swear by him who lives forever, saying,
"It will be for a time, times, and half a time. When the power of the holy people has been finally broken, all these things will be completed."
I heard, but I did not understand. So I asked, "My Lord, what will the outcome of all this be?" He replied,
"Go on your way, Daniel, because the words are closed up and sealed until the time of the end. Many will be purified, made spotless and refined, but the wicked will continue to be wicked. None of the wicked will understand, but those who are wise will understand. From the time that the daily sacrifice is abolished and the abomination that causes desolation is set up, there will be 1,290 days. Blessed is the one who waits for and reaches the end of the 1,335 days. As for you, go on your way till the end. You will rest, and then at the end of the days, you will rise to receive your allotted inheritance."
By the time you come to this chapter, you see you've moved into the super world. Now you've moved to the end of times. Now you've moved to the resurrection of the dead in verse 2. That is the real end we are talking about now. It drops back into 3.5 years, or back into the 1,290 days, which is roughly the period of time that Antiochus Epiphanes did control of the city, roughly. The distinction between that and 1,335 is not made clear. You could have 100 different answers. I gave you one last week, didn't I, about the British soldier conquering Jerusalem in the Muslim year 1335. I mean, there's hundreds of speculations that are available to you, but we really don't know the distinctions being made. But we're talking about the real end now, because this is a very important aspect. See, what happens to all these people? It was clear when you're in Babylon, the promise lay before you. The people of God will own the land of God. But now you're telling me that for centuries they're going to be overrun by these pagans. I mean, what kind of ownership of the land? We may as well stay in Babylon. We'd be better off here. At least we've learned how to keep the Babylonians in check. Some of us have made great fortunes. Daniel himself, third most powerful man in the land. I mean, why do they want to go back to Jerusalem to face all this kind of thing? It doesn't seem the promises are going to be fulfilled. How can it be? And what happens to those who die waiting? And the answer comes, they will not miss out on anything. They won't miss out, for there will be a resurrection. And here is one of the New Testament lights shining through the Old Testament, verse 2 of Daniel 12. The multitude who sleep in the dust of the earth will awake, some to everlasting life and others to shame and everlasting contempt. see, what is the judgment that's going to fall upon the enemies of the people of Israel? Is it just that they're going to die? No, more than that. What about those who died defending the cause of Israel? Are they going to be lost? No, they will be raised up as well. Here is the real end. But in between here, Daniel, and the time of that end, suffering will be the normal course of events. Suffering will be the usual. The people are not going to be at peace until that time at the end. There will be no peace for the wicked or the righteous until the time of the end. That's a very important message, isn't it? To the Babylonian slaves who are just about to be released and who think they're going home to peace, the message is, that's not the truth. You're going home for sufferings. How long, he says? And the answer comes back, a time, times, and half a time. And then verse 8a makes us all feel bad. I heard, all feel good rather, I heard, but I didn't understand. Well, there's a text for you to put on the top of your Bible study desk. I heard, but I didn't understand. So I said, well, what will the outcome be? What is the time, the two times and half a time? Well, it can be the 3.5 years. But 3.5 is symbolic of what? Half of 7. I noticed one of our congregational cars parked outside tonight, number plate 777. That was very appropriate. Got a party with some non-Christian friends last night, and the host had a car whose number plate was 666. So symbolism still hangs around in this world, I see. What is the 3.5? 3.5, half of 7. 7 is completion, well-roundedness, thing running its course, its full course. And what? How long will it be? It will be an interrupted period. Interrupted, someone pointed out when I discussed this on Friday night at the University Church, interrupted sounds like it's going to then start again. So it's a bad word I've used here. It's a period of time that's going to be cut off. That is, evil is going to reign in the world, but it's not going to come to completion. It's not going to run full length, its whole course. Because in the height of its evil, when the people of God are cut down to the absolute rock bottom, that'll be the end. Suddenly it'll be brought to an end by God. How? Well, it's not said here, but it's going to happen. But what of Daniel? Well, Daniel learns that his inheritance is assured, verse 13. As for you, go on your way till the end. You will rest, that is, you'll die, you'll be asleep. And then at the end of the days, you will rise to receive your allotted inheritance. The inheritance, Daniel, you see, is not Jerusalem. It is not Israel. It's not Palestine. It's eternal life. It's resurrected life. And so what has happened is he's talking about salvation here and now, going back home, occupying the promised land. But as he talks about it, he really is talking about something much bigger, more eternal. Because the warfare that is taking place between Persians and Greeks, etc., is really the warfare that's under the control of powers and principalities that are unseen forces of the superworld. So what was Daniel's vision? Three things in particular. One, the man is in control. See, there is somebody who can actually explain it all to us, who has it under control, who may be resisted by the evil ones, but who finally will conquer and win. The man is in control. And we, of course, know that man to be Jesus, risen from the dead, the first fruits of this resurrection, who has been given all authority and power. Second thing is that Daniel learns the restoration from Babylon is only going to be a partial one. Yep, they're going home. Yep, the temple's going to be rebuilt. The holy city's going to be there. But this is not the time of the kingdom of God. This is not the time of peace and security. It's only a partial restoration, looking forward to something else, the ultimate victory, which will come and interrupt the temporary reign of evil. For the time will come, somewhere down the future, the time will come when the resurrection will take place and when righteousness will take place, so that the judgment of the world will be right. For those who have done evil will be punished, will live in shame and everlasting contempt. And to those who are the people of God, will rise and shine like the brightness of the heaven. And so there is ultimate victory, of which Daniel will be a participant. Well, time's against us for lots of reasons now. You might like to ponder it. Is there a burning question someone wants to ask? Rod? I've missed that. Yeah. Will the king who exalts himself be the Antichrist that's referred to in the New Testament? Many scholars have seen it as that. The only trouble with it is that that's a... I can't think of the word, I'm sorry. When you're using a word out of time sequence. An anachronism, yes. We don't know about the Antichrist yet, and the Antichrist in the New Testament comes after the Christ. But I think it's all the same kind of picture. I'm not quite sure that we should draw class very careful distinctions. I didn't call it the Antichrist for that reason, though. However, what the Antichrist does, what Adolf Hitler does, what any person who stands up against God does, is exactly what Antiochus Epiphanes does. He runs the world. He doesn't take the position that God has given him. It's what sin is all about. You do not take the position that God has given you as a man made in the image of God. You rather seek to usurp God's position and run the world for yourself. And of course, once you start doing that, then you tyrannize the people around about you. And if you succeed, then your tyranny increases and increases. And so you continually shake the fist of God and seek to run the world and declare yourself to be God. And megalomania is really just below the surface of us all. Most of us aren't given to it because of lack of opportunity. Our neighbours keep us down. But given the opportunity, when we can rise, we certainly do it. And so, yes, the Antichrist, the Antiochus Epiphanes, anyone who cares to stand against God like that is much the same. They're all birds of a slightly different coloured feather, but they're the same family. And it's not unreasonable to think that that's the Antichrist, that's what's taking place. Although it's not made explicit, that it's fair to see the man who is explaining it is a Christophany, is a revelation of Jesus, yes. Yes. In chapter 9 it's Gabriel. Jehovah's Witnesses believe Michael is Jesus. Just because they believe it doesn't mean it's wrong. Did Daniel seal up the writings till the end? He's only told that about chapter 8, isn't he? Is he chapter told that here too? 12 verse 4, yes, seal it up. Seal up the words of the scroll until the time of the end. And so Michael's good question here is, if he sealed it up till the end, how come we've got it? What an interesting question. I don't know what it means there at that point. It's opened in Revelation, but this is known before then. Pete? Sorry, say it again. Yeah, thanks, Pete, I get it. Yeah, the reference to the sufferings of the time, the two times and the half time, does that mean that just before the coming of the final moment, the suffering is going to be worse, if anything? I think that the New Testament perceives the coming of the Messiah as a time of particular suffering. And so there is what is called the Messianic woes, and that comes out of this passage. But I think that Jesus says that those times are always with us. We're in them now. And so at any moment in history, you can actually see there are wars and rumours of wars. There are people persecuted for the name of Jesus. There are, at this moment, people who are in prison because they're Christians around the world. May not be here in Sydney, but Sydney is a very small place compared to the world and the Christianity in the world. And there are people all over the world who are...
Thank you for listening to the talks on philipjensen.com. Please check our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material on philipjensen.com.